Welcome to the True Crime Cafe. I'm Angie.
I'm Becky, and you won't believe the case I have for you today.
What do you have for us today, Becky?
So today I have for you a case that I had not originally planned to talk about today. But after we talked about the situation with the lack of coverage for Indigenous women, when we were talking about Samantha Fiddler in the last case that I hosted, I knew that I had to rocket Sonia Ivanov's story to the top of my list because this is a thing I cannot let go of. Like, I knew it was a problem after I watched the series Alaska Daily, which used actual cases, I realized it was a bigger problem than what I had read about before. And the first time I heard about Sonia was on an episode of Dateline, which, you know, I'm addicted to Dateline because of Keith Morrison, the silver box of true crime. And this story takes place in Nome, Alaska. Now, Alaska does not have, they have state troopers, but they don't really have like town cops like where I live now in South Carolina, and even in West Virginia, every little town had its own police force. But in Alaska, it's not like that. They have a, what is it called?
Village safety patrol officer.
So Sonia's village was no different. It had a village public safety officer, and, you know, that was about it. Sonia Ivanov was the fourth of six kids. She was described as goofy and fun. She played basketball, and she was well known with a good reputation in her town and the surrounding communities, which, as you and I know about Alaska, they're close, but not really close because it's Alaska and it's huge and it's very rural. And Sonia had spent her whole life in Alaska. She was from the tiny town of Unalakleet. She decided that when she graduated, she wanted to go to college in Hawaii, which if I grew up in Alaska and spent my whole life there, I would want to go somewhere warm.
That's a big difference.
It really is. But she couldn't afford to go all at once. And in her tiny town where everybody knew everybody, it meant everyone knew everybody else's business.
Of course.
So she moved to Nome to work and save money for college. And her friend Timory moved to Nome a little bit later. I think it was about a year later. And they were roommates, and they both had jobs, and they're good girls. So Nome's motto is, there's no place like Nome. And it's home of the Iditarod sled dog race. So the Dateline episode of this case painted a pretty desolate picture of the town of Nome. It's cold. In the video footage, everything was gray. There are a lot of bars, and there are good things too. Like, after moving to Nome, Sonia participated in the Arctic Native Brotherhood pageant for Indigenous women in hopes of earning some scholarship money. And she worked nights at the admitting desk in the local hospital. So after Timory moved to Alaska, she found work at a hotel. Neither girl owned a car, and the town of Nome was small enough that they felt comfortable walking everywhere. And the town of Nome is about the size of the town where I live. And you've been here. There are, what, like two stoplights?
I think so.
Yeah, if you blink. Yeah, if you blink, you'll miss it.
A stoplight, a stop sign. I don't.
It's pretty small. When we first moved here, we used to call it the Mayberry of South Carolina. On the night of August 10th, 2003, Sonia and Timory went out to have a fun time with their friends. And for them, a fun time with their friends was like playing board games. There was alcohol, but nobody was like really getting trashed. It wasn't like a party that you'd have down here in South Carolina on the beach. That night, Sonia only had one beer. Sometime around 1 a.m., she told Timory she was not feeling well and she was going to walk home. And the last time Timory saw Sonia, Sonia was walking in the direction of where they lived. So I was curious, and I looked up what the weather would have been that night, because I know what August nights are like here in South Carolina. They can be pretty humid and muggy.
Hot and sticky.
Yeah, hot and sticky. But the daytime temperatures were in the 70s that day, and it was only around 60 degrees at that time of night. The rain was a light rain, so it wasn't like torrential downpours or anything. It was the kind of rain that you might want to walk in. And being 19 years old, Sonia liked walking in the rain. And yeah, I get it. When I was 19, I liked walking in the rain. When you live in a climate as cold as Alaska, that far north, 60 is kind of balmy. So I think it probably would have felt pretty good. I know that when our air conditioning was out earlier this month and we were left our windows open, when it got down to 60 at night, it felt pretty good here. So when Timory woke up the next morning and Sonia was not there, Her loved ones thought maybe she just met up with a friend and stayed over. No one heard from her, but they weren't worried until they missed her shift at the hospital the next day, like the next day after that, the 12th. So on August 12th, Timmery contacted the Nome Police Department to ask if Sonia had been arrested. And when the police said that she hadn't, Timmery tried to report Sonia missing. Timmery was worried because Sonia's makeup bag was untouched and Sonia did not go anywhere without doing her hair and makeup first. And it was not like Sonia to just up and disappear. She would have gotten in touch with someone. And again, this was 2003. They had internet. They had emails. They had technology in general. At this point in my research, I wasn't too sure about cell phones because I know at this time they were becoming really popular in the lower 48 states. Because let's see, my kids would have been in preschool at this point because we got our first phones in 2006 when our oldest was in second grade because of some behavior issues at school and they needed to get in touch with us. So that's how I remember when we got our first phones. I was the last person in my family to get a phone. So nothing at this point in our research says anything about them pinging cell towers, tracing calls, any of that that we talk about in more recent cases of true crime. But the police didn't really take Timmery seriously. Big shocker, right? Police force not taking a report about a missing Indigenous woman seriously. But I will be more on that soapbox later. By now, Sonia's sister, Christine, and her brother-in-law, Tom, had started reaching out to people who knew Sonia. They went to the police station to ask where they could find the camp of a man named Konak, who was a friend of Sonia's. And Tom's to the police seemed very disinterested.
Again, not a big shocker.
Not a big shocker. Konak was a friend of Sonia's, so the police didn't really take it seriously until Sonia's boss called to report that she was missing.
Okay.
So the authorities went to her home and searched, found all her things still there. Again, not a good sign. The police questioned Timmery about her friendship with Sonia. They wanted to know what Sonia's mental state was before she went missing and the usual things they asked. And they actually asked Timmery, are you sure your friend just isn't at a party? Like, yeah, my friend was at a party for the past 3 or 4 days, right? Ridiculous, ridiculous line of questioning. In my mind, it's a ridiculous line of questioning.
Agreed.
Timmery told police that Sonia's mood was happy. The two roommates were not arguing. And if they did argue, they would talk it through and quickly make up. I heard a recording of this interview and Timmery sounds on the verge of tears, especially when she said, I can't stand being home and just sitting there because Sonia's not there. And the officer said, she's somewhere. Like, I heard that on the recording. That is exactly what he said. Yes.
No.
Yes. So the police are right. Right. Yeah. I said a lot of words. My mom would have probably washed my mouth out with the soap if she heard the words I said.
Right.
So the police are finally on board. They get together a search party and the search was on land and in water. And Christine and Tom said this is where they really got concerned because they were concerned before. But it's like, hey, she's just missing. Maybe she is at a friend's house. Maybe she, you know, maybe she decided to take her. Who knows? Maybe she's somewhere. But when they start searching on land and in water, anytime you search for a missing person in water, it's, you know, at this point,
you're expecting to find a body, not a live person.
Right. So it's the difference between a rescue and a recovery mission. So unfortunately, 2.5 days after Sonia was, I don't know if it was 2.5 days after she went missing or was reported missing, but a volunteer firefighter who was helping with the search party followed some tracks down a road, which was seldom used. It was more of a trail off an old mining track. Mm-hmm. And that's when he found Sonia's nude body. Her face was bruised and she had been shot in the back of the head. So this area was called Bessie Pit and it'll come up later, but Bessie Pit was an abandoned sand and gravel mine in Alaska's Seward Peninsula, which if you look at a map of Alaska, there are like three peninsulas on the western side. Mm-hmm. And this is the one in the middle. And it's kind of like pointing at Russia. So, and to say that it was a rural area would be an understatement. Like if you look on Google Maps, there's just nothing there. The police went to Christina and Tom's house and told them about what happened. And Tom called Sonia's parents. He said it was the hardest call he ever had to make. I can't imagine that as a parent, I can't imagine telling another parent that their child is never coming home. Timory said when she found out, she just dropped. She could not believe her friend was gone. And when I was 19, my best friend was my roommate. She was a maid of honor at my wedding. Mm-hmm. And about 11 years ago, I learned that she passed away due to illness. And that was another reason this case tugged at me. Because if I had lost my best friend to a crime like this when I was 19, I would have been devastated. That's an understatement. Like, I cannot even imagine what Sonia's family and loved ones are going through.
Mm-mm, not at all.
So for the police, this missing person case is now a murder case. And the police department covered the crime scene with a tarp until officials from Anchorage could travel to Nome to help with the case. When the investigators got there from the Alaska Bureau of Investigation, they had caught the first flight out. And the criminologist immediately found clues, including mismatched tire tracks and blue paint scrapings on a tree branch. Around this time, a tip had come into the police department from someone who said she saw Sonia get into a vehicle, but nobody had followed up on the tip. So suspect number one was the person that Sonia's family was looking for, Kuna. When Sonia had missed work, her sister Christina and Christina's husband Tom also began to worry because they knew that Kuna, whose real name is Daniel Angusuk, I think it's pronounced, and if not, then I apologize, but they knew he had a crush on Sonia. She did not feel the same way. Kuna was described as a hothead by people who knew him, and the police confirmed that he had a history of domestic abuse. Also, he drove a blue truck with mismatched tires. They're thinking it's a slam dunk. There was no DNA on Sonia besides her own. Rape kit was negative, but all the circumstantial evidence pointed at Kunuk, especially when you hear that his truck had a lot of blood on it. There were three rifles behind the driver's seat, one of which had blood on the butt of it. And there was a significant amount of blood on his shoes, and there were drops of blood on the floorboard of the truck. So his story was that he was hunting 70 miles away on the night that Sonia was killed. He said the blood was because he killed a porcupine and a rabbit. But if he killed these animals so aggressively with a vehicle, wouldn't that make him more of a suspect? Like, to me, it was like, oh, well, he's violent. Like, and as I was researching this, the more I read about him, like, red flag, red flag. So he said he killed a rabbit with the truck and it didn't die right away. So he killed it with the gun and he shot the porcupine while hunting. And I'm like, how freaking big was this rabbit that it put all this blood? Like, was it a jackalope? Were they, you know? So he said that the defensive wounds the police found on his body were caused during an argument with his baby mama. So they start testing all the evidence. All the blood on his vehicle was animal blood. The tire, the tires on his truck did not match those at the crime scene. So with no circumstantial evidence against him, no actual evidence against him, the police had to cut him loose. So Christina said that they were not going to have an open casket funeral due to the bruising on Sonia's face, but she knew her sister liked to look good. So Christina did Sonia's makeup to cover the wound so Sonia could have an open casket and so she could look good one last time. And Sonia's brother-in-law went to the police station and said he put a picture of Sonia on the wall to remind police that her killer was still out there. Officer Matt Owens found this upsetting and made him take it down.
Why?
I'm not sure, but we're going to find out.
Okay.
So a week after Sonia went missing, the only two officers who remained on her case out of the eight who originally worked on it in Nome were Brian Weavana and Byron Redburn. They were both from Nome, and I'm not sure if these were the only two guys working on it because they were not working the night she went missing or what. But
to me, it makes sense to have two police officers who are from Nome to work the case because from what I've seen, like these small villages and stuff like that, they are like the people who live there are trusting of outsiders. So I could see why if Nome is like that.
But there were eight officers in Nome who were working the case. And there were other officers who worked in Nome, like the guy Matt Owens. He worked in Nome, but these two guys were the only ones still working the case. In a Google Arts and Culture article, Brian Weavana, who left after 15 years of police work to work for Alaska Airlines, described working in Nome as 39 and a half hours of boredom and half an hour of, oh shit. And he said this was definitely one of those moments. And he was a friend of Christina and Tom. He was also an Indigenous person. And he decided that he was going to start from scratch and go through the case piece by piece to look for evidence. And it helped that at this time he was working the night shift and he had a lot of time on his hands after the bars closed down at 3 a.m. till the end of a shift. So those were the hours that he would dedicate to investigating. And he found a note with a tip from the woman who said she had seen something the night Sonia went missing, but nobody ever interviewed her. He had no idea when the note was written or who put it there, but he knew he had to talk to this person. An Alaska newspaper reported that Florence Habros and her sister Danite, I think it's pronounced, were standing on the porch of their mother's house on Sapala Drive when they saw a young woman walk towards them on the sidewalk. It was dark. It was around 1:30 in the morning and it was drizzling. And Florence said to her sister, "That's Sonia Ivanov." Now, her sister was a sophomore and an athlete at Nome High School, and she knew who Sonia was because they had seen her play basketball. And Sonia also stood out because she was 5'11". She was really tall. Mm-hmm. As Sonia walked by, within about 20 feet of the women, she greeted them and kept walking down the street towards her house. They said that Sonia was less than a block away when a marked police vehicle pulled in front of her on West D Street. The passenger's side window lowered. Sonia leaned in the vehicle. A few minutes later, Sonia climbed in the vehicle, shut the door, and the patrol car drove away in the opposite direction of where Sonia and Timory lived. And it was the direction of where they would later find Sonia's body. Florence said when she heard about Sonia's disappearance, she wanted to call the police, but she was nervous. So she went to work and she had someone else dial the number for the police because she couldn't even dial the number. Mm-hmm. And being in a small town, if the police have a strong presence, I don't know. I might be nervous too. She waited for someone to get back with her, but as weeks went by, no one did until Brian Wayabana found the tip and contacted her, which was in September 2003 when he rotated back to day shift. So this is several weeks later. The Alaska Daily reported that a different trooper said that the police originally wrote Florence's last name down wrong, and that was the reason for the delay. And that when no one contacted her, Florence's husband encouraged her to have a friend make a video of her statement about what she saw that night. So she sent that into the police around the same time that the note was found. And the state trooper said that this made Florence a very credible witness. Florence said if it came down to testifying in court, she was scared, but that her husband and family have supported her. She said she could not forget how peaceful Sonia looked on the night she passed by the porch, and she would testify because she wants Sonia to be free. So the car that Sonia got into was a patrol car from the Nome police. And anyone who watched the show Alaska Daily, which sadly was canceled after one season, so all the episodes are on Hulu though, you will know that the police situation in Alaska is just seriously jacked up. Because as we've already said, a lot of the little villages, they only have like a representative, and just the small towns like Nome have just a couple police officers on shift at any given time. My small town in South Carolina has more than two police officers on shift at any given time now. I don't know what it was like in 2003, but we're a smaller town than Nome. So Brian Wayabana went to his commanding officer and said, "Hey, we need to hand this over to the Alaska Bureau of Investigation." And they returned to take over the case. Christina and Tom at this point, Sonia's sister and brother-in-law, only knew that the ABI was back and that their top priority was to find out who was driving that patrol car. The Nome Police Department had a limited number of patrol cars. I think it was only two or three. So nobody had a take-home vehicle. The vehicles were always in use. It's not like police today where, you know, you get your handcuffs, your gun, your badge, your car, and you're set. Two officers on duty the night Sonia went missing were Stan Piscoya and Matthew Owens, who each had a different police vehicle. Stan Piscoya was the one who Timory said didn't take her seriously when she reported Sonia missing. And Matt Owens was the one who made Tom take Sonia's picture down. So the ABI asked these two officers to fly to Anchorage for interviews and lie detector tests. And Stan was like, "Okay, I'll do it." But before Matt could get there, one of the police cruisers turned up missing on a night when Matt Owens was on duty. So he found the patrol car in Bessie Pit, the area where Sonia's body had been found, and he called in to report shots fired. He said a shot was fired, followed by a second shot, and he took off running into the tundra. And Matt Owens said he was terrified. He could not imagine his four-year-old son growing up without a father. And he started to question whether he was cut out for police work. Now, as for the patrol vehicle, there were no fingerprints or DNA found, but a rifle was missing, and a window had been broken out by a rock. And police also found an envelope under the front seat that was addressed to the cops. And it was allegedly from Sonia's killer. In the Dateline episode, I believe Josh Mankiewicz was the host on that one. And he said the note was described like something out of a movie. And in my research, I found like a picture of the handwritten note. And it said, "Higgs, I hate cops. I hate every one of you. Sonya was just a person in the wrong place at the wrong time. I did not know her, as you can see. It was easy for me to take your pig car keys right there. It was not her fault. She thought I was a pig and shit just happened. She was just a person. And I just wanted to see if I could that night. Every one of you should be more careful. I watch every movie you make. You leave me alone and I will leave you alone. I will also shoot you in the head if you get close." So Eric Burrows from the ABI said inside the note was Sonya's rec center ID, but he was skeptical. Everyone knows who the officers are. And if it was an unknown person who stole the patrol vehicle, Sonya would not have leaned in the window to talk to them that night, much less got in the vehicle with them. So as we've established, there were only two people on shift that night.
Mm-hmm.
So Matt Owens could not get to Anchorage to be interviewed because he was too shaken up from being shot at. And he voluntarily went to a therapist to talk through his issue. And it's worth pointing out that when the Alaska State Police tried to reenact this, they found it was basically impossible to have the situation happen about the stolen patrol car and the shots being fired the way that Matt Owens described it. Stan Piscoya said he and Matt Owens went on a domestic violence call before 1:30 in the morning on the night that Sonya disappeared. By 2 a.m., he was at the station doing reports, which the paperwork that he did was able to prove. When asked who he thought was responsible, he said the officers. Now, I'm not sure if he meant Matt Owens or someone else, but that was his answer.
Me too.
Yeah, but 5 days later, it was Matt Owens' turn to be interviewed. And the ABI asked Matt Owens the same questions they'd asked Stan Piscoya. Matt's recollection of the night that Sonya disappeared was similar to Stan's. He said he was on patrol. He monitored bar closings. He took Stan home. Matt Owens then went back to the station to write some reports. He heard a sound like a gunshot. He went back out on patrol for about an hour. He couldn't find anything. He took a call that came in, and then his shift was over. So when apparently this is how it happens when your shift is over. You go to the next officer on duty's house. You pick them up. That officer takes you home, and then they go on their shift with the car.
Okay.
So the car is always with an officer. Yeah. And that's how Matt Owens described the end of his night on the night that Sonya went missing. Or at that point, I guess it would have been early morning.
Mm-hmm.
And during the interview, Matt Owens volunteered this little tidbit. He said, "You know, Stan and I are, you know, obviously not the only ones that are doing this." So even though both their stories lined up, the ABI was convinced that somebody was lying. So Eric Burrows with the ABI, who is almost at the Keith Morrison level for me in true crime advocates. And if you saw him on the Dateline episode, he was just so passionate about solving this case. And he learned that Matt Owens often requested the night shift because he liked to have ride-alongs for company. And all his buddies were female. And while he was on duty, it was not unusual for him to have sex in his patrol car.
So is that what he was referring to when he said that him and Stan were not the only police officers who were doing that?
I have no idea. So they talked to some of these women. Some women seemed like they were there voluntarily. Some said Matt Owens would follow them, drive ahead, and then cut them off while they were walking. And that's exactly what Florence and her sister saw him do to Sonya. And Sonya knew Matt because she worked nights at the hospital. And if you're working in a hospital, it's a given that you're going to cross paths with first responders, especially in a small town like Nome, where everybody knows everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's not quite as small as the town where Sonya came from, but it's still a small town. So an article in the Alaska Daily reported the district attorney's office as saying that when the investigators had talked to more than four young women who were either followed by, picked up by, or had sex with Matt Owens while he was on duty, and troopers had leads on three more women, two in Anchorage and one in a village, whom they were trying to track down.
Matt Owens not a good guy.
No. So Matt Owens failed his polygraph.
Not surprising.
No. And even though, you know, polygraphs are not admissible in court, I think it's just one more nail in the proverbial coffin for him, because it tells investigators it's kind of like a bolo, you know, be on the lookout for more evidence. He did admit to giving rides to other women, but he had denied ever having sex with them. And Matt Owens got very defensive and asked, "Why is my sex life part of this investigation or whatever? Why do we need to talk about my sex life?" And the investigator said, "Because your sex life happened on duty."
Exactly.
So at this point, Matt Owens has not been charged with any crime. When he got back to Nome, he was on suspension and in the middle of a messy divorce and living in a friend's spare room. Investigators soon talked to Matt Owens, soon to be ex-wife, who said that Matt called her on his birthday, August 12th, to ask her to pick up their son early so he could go to work because a young woman had been reported missing. Now, Sonia went missing on August 10th. She was found a day and a half later, or two and a half days later, except that Matt Owens called his wife before Timmery called the police. On October 25th, 2003, 2.5 months after Sonia was murdered, Matt Owens was arrested. And when they went to the trial, Christina and Tom were met with hostilities. Brian Weavana said they were met with a lot of disrespect from people who supported the police. And 2 days later, Matt Owens was fired from his job as a police officer, and women began coming forward like in droves to report that they had either been coerced into having sex or he had just outright sexually assaulted them. And all this happened while he was on duty. It's like he was getting paid to commit crimes.
He was abusing his authority.
Yes. Oh, that's the least of it, you know? And he told one woman, nobody's going to believe a drunk woman over a police officer. Also, after Sonia's disappearance, Matt Owens was seen at a place called Coffee Creek, about 70 miles away from Nome. And he was burning items, including a pair of brand new gloves. And when investigators went to the site, they treated it like they were panning for gold to sift through the rubble. And it paid off. In those ashes, they found an eyelet that matched Sonia's Skechers brand shoes, which she was wearing on the night it disappeared. They found a button from jeans that, according to her sister Christina, were the same brand she was known to wear. They found a key to Matt's uncle's post office box. And a little more investigation turned up a bullet casing. So Byron Redburn, who had worked with Brian Weavana, suggested that investigators look in the Nome Police Department's evidence area for a gun that would match the bullet casing. And when investigators checked this out, they were surprised to see that anybody could borrow evidence at any time. The police department was so small that how would anyone know? Because there were only two people on shift at a time, especially night shift, which Matt Owens often requested. So Matt Owens' service weapon did not match the bullet casing, and there were no forensics to lead him to the murder weapon. After 2 months in jail, Matt Owens made bail, got supervised release, and got a high-powered attorney. Now, in a different case, the suspect's family member had said, the only people in jail are people who can't afford a good attorney. And while we were watching that, like, that whole phrase just haunted me because it's like, man, I hope this doesn't happen here. On January 18th, 2005, the trial began, and it was 17 months after Sonia's murder, which is pretty quick. Some trials take years, even decades, to just begin. I was reading about a trial that the murder had happened like 27 years ago, and they finally got enough evidence through DNA to prosecute the offender. And some of this victim's family members they're no longer even alive now to see this trial come to justice. But so 17 months is pretty quick.
Oh, yeah.
But to the victim's family, and I'm speaking from experience here, it can still feel like forever just to get that court date. The prosecution interviewed 70 witnesses, and they put together a very strong case, even though it was all put together with circumstantial evidence. Three witnesses saw Sonia on foot between where she left Timmery and to the point where Florence saw her get in the patrol car. Matt Owens' uncle said he never gave a mailbox key to his nephew. Matt Owens took the stand in his own defense and said his ex-wife had her dates wrong, and the call took place a week later than it actually had, because, like, she's not going to remember her ex-husband's birthday.
Right.
Matt Owens had looked up Sonia on the internet and had run her name, but said it was a matter of curiosity, and he wanted to make sure she was of legal drinking age. The judge ruled all the sex allegations as inadmissible.
What?
Yeah. And Matt Owens' lawyer said that because Byron Redburn suggested where investigators should look for the murder weapon, then he should have been a witness. They went so far as to suggest that Byron Redburn was framing Matt Owens for the murder because Matt Owens was sleeping with Byron Redburn's daughter. And the defense brought up Kunuk as an alternate suspect, even though they proved that he had nothing to do with it. Like, not that he had nothing to do with it, but the paint markings, the tires, the blood and stuff, like, none of that had anything to do with Sonia's, like, being missing or murdered.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, the jury jury was deadlocked and the judge declared a mistrial. Part of the reason for this was because the trial was held in Nome, where a lot of the jurors knew Matt Owens and went to church with him. So Sonia's family is heartbroken, and her mother said that to go through the first trial was hard, and to go through the second was just as hard. She said it's not something you want anyone to go through, and she's right. It's a very hard thing to go through, because there's evidence they show, especially the forensic evidence, that stays with you. And just because evidence is shown to a jury doesn't mean the family members should ever have to see it. Mm-hmm. Some of it you just can't unsee ever. Matt Owens' lawyer suggested a change of venue to get a fair trial. And the second trial began 7 months later in Kotzebue, which is north of Nome and closer to the Arctic Circle. The prosecution's case was almost identical in this trial than it was to the first trial. During the middle of the trial, Eric Burrs from the ABI got some new evidence, though. Yeah, Brian Wayavana, some of the evidence came out. It was a jaw-dropping moment. He was randomly talking to a neighbor who said, hey, did it ever come up that a woman rented a room to Matt Owens and saw Sonia's ID in Matt's rented room? Yeah, because if this was the ID card from the burn pit, it's like a smoking gun. Mm-hmm. So Eric Burrs from the ABI talked to Brian Wayavana's neighbor, whose name was Dealey Blackshear, who said that the woman who rented the room saw a woman's wallet and ID card before the missing patrol car incident and the burn pit finding. Then Eric Burrs got a warrant to share a call between Dealey Blackshear and this woman, who said she did not report it to the police because she heard they already had the ID. They raced to get everything entered into the trial as evidence, and they get the woman on the stand, and she denied everything. But luckily, they had a recording of her conversation, so they played it. Mm-hmm. And this time, when the jury came back, it was with a guilty verdict.
Yes.
Yeah. I was waiting. I was like, I wanted to tell you, but I wanted to like let it be a surprise. I wanted to surprise you with it. So Sonia was outspoken. And the theory is that when Matt Owens, who had his eye on her for a while, had seen an opportunity to approach her for sex, she may have threatened to report him for abuse of power. And if he had a weapon and threatened her, maybe he forced her to get in the car with him. Now, I'm not sure if I mentioned this, but there was no evidence that Sonia was sexually assaulted. It wasn't just a rape kit came back clean. There was no evidence at all. Investigators suspect that while he was out on patrol, he saw Sonia, he propositioned her, and when she refused, he realized she wasn't drunk and would have more credibility if she reported him. And after a confrontation, he killed her. Eric Burrs feels that Matt Owens probably would have killed again, and he thinks that Sonia's death probably stopped a potential serial killer situation.
At the very least, a serial rapist.
Right. Timmery feels guilty for not walking Sonia home, and in the time since this happened, she said that she distrusts the police so much that she had to leave college because seeing anyone in a uniform triggers anxiety for her. And this part broke my heart. Her dad said, she had a big heart and I sure do miss her. Her mother said, I never thought I would lose a daughter to a policeman. They're supposed to protect. It kind of messed up my trusting police officers.
I can imagine.
Right? In the time since this case, the distrust that people of Nome have for police has multiplied. Also, in 2007, the Sonia Ivanov bill was signed into law, and the law mandates that a maximum sentence for first-degree murder to any officer who murders someone while on duty. So if an officer murders someone while on duty, they automatically get the maximum sentence. One of the things that really bothers me was that the white police force didn't immediately take the missing person report more seriously than they did. This was in 2003, 20 years ago. Uh-huh. And it's taken this long for people to scratch the tip of the iceberg that is this massive issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women to have a voice. And to be honest, I'm kind of embarrassed that I've lived in this little bubble and it took me so long to find out about it. If not for this podcast, I still might not know about it. So listeners, if you really want to help Indigenous women who are still missing or are the victims of cold cases, you can help by being a voice. Share this episode and ones like it from other true crime podcasts with your friends or just on social media. Use the hashtag MMIW. And you can also check out the website called Native Hope. And you can join uncovered.com, a website that crowdsources information about cold cases. And the people who manage the site are awesome. Angie and I have attended their events, their Zoom events. They have true crime trivia, and They're very patient in answering all your questions when you get started. They have tutorials on how you can help provide info. And I just can't say enough good things about them. I just love the people at Uncovered.com.
Yes, they're truly passionate about finding answers for these cases.
Yes. Thank you for hanging in here with us. And thank you in advance for using your voice to help bring awareness to crimes against Indigenous women. And that's all I have for today.
Like, I hear cases like this.
Mm-hmm.
And first and foremost, I think one of the reasons why these cases shock me so much is because you don't hear a lot about the Indigenous women.
Right.
You just don't. So while when you start hearing about them and you're thinking, oh, it's just this little bubble, and you go down the quote unquote rabbit hole and you realize that it is this humongous widespread issue. Another reason why cases like this piss me off is because you have somebody who is in a position of authority, who is supposed to protect others, who is supposed to be the quote unquote good guy.
Mm-hmm.
And they abuse that power. They abuse that trust that people put in them. And let's be clear, my opinion is there are far, far, far more good police officers than there are bad police officers. Sadly, though, when we talk about true crime cases, especially in certain areas like Alaska,
mm-hmm.
You see that it's a good old boy system. There's not a lot of representation of the natives of that area.
Right.
Let's be honest. If Sonia had been a white woman who all of a sudden went missing in mm-hmm. Alaska, the police would have been all over it.
It'd have been all over the news.
I mean, let's be completely honest.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that these Indigenous women can just go missing or be murdered and their cases are just never solved because the police departments don't have the motivation or the resources.
Or whatever reason.
Whatever the reason is. These could put the same amount into these cases as they do for white women or missing children. Mm-hmm. Or elderly who go missing or whatever. It's just, it's heartbreaking.
It is that,
as you said, like I learned about how widespread this issue was when I joined Uncovered.com because they have a whole section dedicated to it. And it's heartbreaking when you realize how many families don't ever get an answer
mm-hmm.
because these women are part of a forgotten group. It's just, I'm glad Sonia's family got justice.
Stay caffeinated.
And join us next time for another cup of crime.